It's Monday, November 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, the death of Fidel Castro and what may lie ahead for the island nation.
They are unhappy with what's going on in Turkey, but they don't want to be the side, the party which initiates the suspension of the talks.
Turkey's EU membership hinges on migrants. Also ahead, online shoppers beware of holiday thieves. And a simple test. Many will help see the world differently. It's all on today's International Edition. Cubans are mourning Fidel Castro, the country's revolutionary leader whose death was announced Saturday. Flags are flying at half-staff across the country as Cuba enters a week filled with memorials to mark his passing. The socialist revolutionary, who had long been ill, died late Friday at the age of 90. A cause of death has not been announced. A series of memorials begins today when Cubans gather in Havana's iconic Revolution Square, where Castro often addressed adoring crowds. On Wednesday, Castro's ashes will be carried eastward across the country in a three-day procession that follows in reverse the route taken by the young revolutionary and his rebel fighters as they advanced on Havana before taking power in January 1959. He will be buried December 4th in the southeastern city of Santiago de Cuba. In Miami Sunday, Cuba's most prominent opposition group, known as the Ladies in White, joined with other dissident organizations in calling for unified public demonstrations Wednesday in support of democracy in Cuba. Their call came as hundreds of Cuban Americans in several areas of the United States took to the streets to celebrate the demise of the communist leader. The Ladies in White group was founded in 2003 to support husbands jailed for political opposition in the one-party island nation. The anti-Castro group has been organized weekly in marches in the Cuban-American sector of Miami for the past 13 years. The death of Fidel Castro comes just a couple of years into the thawing of U.S. relations with the communist island nation after a freeze of more than 50 years. VOA's Amy Katz takes a look at what impact his death may have and how President-elect Donald Trump may handle the relationship.
It was something that hadn't been seen in more than 50 years. In July of 2015, the American flag rose over the U.S. Embassy in Havana, marking the end of estrangement between the two countries. Months later, the first U.S. president to set foot on Cuban soil since the revolution that brought Fidel Castro to power in 1959.
I have come here to bury the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas. I have come here to extend the hand of friendship to the Cuban people.
U.S. President Barack Obama went on to say that he knew there were still differences between the Cuban and American governments, especially on democracy and human rights, but the best way to address the differences is through engagement. And so began the loosening of restrictions on Cuba intended to create more economic opportunities. Experts believe it was important for the progression on the island to begin while Fidel Castro was still alive. But they acknowledge there is still more work to be done. Brian Fonseca of Florida International University spoke with VOA via Skype.
That said, I don't think that his death itself is going to have profound changes in terms of the political evolution in Cuba.
Critics believe there should have been promises from Cuba to improve its human rights record before any changes in U.S. policy were made. President-elect Donald Trump promised during his campaign that he would reverse Obama's executive orders regarding Cuba unless the Castro regime meets U.S. demands.
Those demands will include religious and political freedom for the Cuban people and the freeing of political prisoners.
Cuba observers don't expect much on the island to change in the wake of Fidel Castro's death. Cuban-American Congresswoman Ileana Ross Leitanen of Florida is among them.
Fidel Castro has really been out of the public scene for many years. The transition to Raul Castro has already taken place. So will there be real change in Cuba with Fidel's death? Well, at least it's a psychological burden that needed to be lifted.
Others, such as Florida International University's Fonseca, speaking to VOA on Skype, are more hopeful.
Could it sort of... intensify or increase the speed at which, you know, change comes into Cuba. I mean, that's possible, because one thing that the death of Fidel does is create some space politically, at least in Cuba, for politicians to maybe think about taking the island in a different direction.
Over the past 2 years, U.S. policy on Cuba had shifted. With the election of a new president and Fidel Castro's death, it seems it may shift again. Amy Katz, VOA News, Washington.
Time for us now to check out what's trending on the web. And for that, our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee, joins me here in Studio 22. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
Well, Fidel Castro, who ruled Cuba with an iron fist for the longest time, died this weekend. Mm-hmm. What's the buzz online?
Former U.S. presidential contenders discuss his legacy during Sunday's morning shows, and excerpts from those interviews are trending online.
Okay, let's hear from the Republican side first.
Sure. Texas Senator Ted Cruz said on ABC News that he's thankful Castro is no longer with us. Florida Senator Marco Rubio, who is a practicing Catholic, said on CNN he doesn't agree with Pope Francis and President Barack Obama on sending condolences to the former dictator.
And what about from the Democrats?
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders appeared on ABC and said he does not praise Fidel Castro and that the Cuban economy is a disaster.
Okay. It seems like President Obama is not the only world leader who might be in the hot seat for offering condolences to the Castros.
That's right. Actually, not too far from us, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau shared a statement on Twitter in which he referred to the late president as a remarkable leader. Now, the top comment to that tweet was by Yoseop Kim, who wrote, "I love you, but why are you praising a monster?" Another person wrote, "As a Canadian, I am ashamed that you just warmly eulogized a murderous dictator instead of remembering his countless victims."
Okay, a lot of discussion on it. What else is trending online?
Now, changing the gear a little bit, the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix kicked off this weekend, and people at the event are sharing photos of a commercial jet and a troop of military acrobatic jets flying into the sky, and you can find those photos and videos on Twitter. Back to you, Jim.
Okay, well, that's quite a way to start a race. Thank you so much, G, and you can follow us on Twitter on our program's account at VOA_IE. I'm out there at VOA Stevenson, and G is at G Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are currently trending in Asia, South Korea's farmers join anti-park protests. Kabul police raid shisha cafes in debauchery crackdown. Gay rights activists march in annual New Delhi parade. 7 dead, 1 missing in New Zealand boat accident. Pakistan appoints a new military chief. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and a whole lot more at the voanews.com website. And take your news with you. If you have a smartphone, try out our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. The death late Friday of Fidel Castro has led many varied emotions in Cuba and the United States, and the event itself may or may not lead to a quick transformation of the island nation. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman previously reported for VOA from our Miami bureau and has been to Cuba. He's now in our studio with his perspective of the passing of the former Cuban dictator.
Jim, not surprisingly, there have been parades and tremendous festivities in South Florida, home to millions of Cuban exiles and their families and children. On the island of Cuba, it is, by all accounts, very somber and very quiet right now, as the nation is in a 9-day mourning period. Even people who defended Fidel Castro would admit that his record on human rights, on liberties, on freedoms, left a great deal to be desired. Independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders was on television this morning. He's the only senator that does not mind the label socialist. And even he said that he had nothing good to say about Fidel Castro's human rights record. On the other hand, he did point out, which I think is fair, that under Fidel Castro's leadership, Cuba did make some advances in terms of health care, in terms of literacy, in terms of nutrition, in terms of education and in terms of some of the basic necessities of life, if you will, but clearly at a tremendous cost.
The United States went through the Cuban Missile Crisis in the early 1960s, and that certainly cast a pall over relations for decades to come, as we basically blockaded the country and didn't have trade, didn't have formal diplomatic relations with the nation, and were essentially cut off from Cuba.
We were, although that all changed under President Barack Obama, who reopened relations, and there is now a functioning U.S. embassy in Havana and a functioning Cuban embassy here in Washington. The question is, what changes as a result of Fidel Castro's death? And I would argue very little. This is a man who had stepped aside and handed over the reins of power to his brother Raul, who remains sort of the spiritual leader of socialism on the island, and someone who was clearly beloved by a great many Cubans who remained on the island and remained loyal to the regime. But Raul Castro has shown no inclination to embrace any sort of liberalization on the economy or when it comes to political rights and basic freedoms. So I don't see any great immediate change there. I would argue that the greatest potential for change actually came in this country earlier this month, which is with the election of President-elect Donald Trump. Donald Trump came out with a very harsh statement on Fidel Castro's rule in Cuba. And the question is, once he is inaugurated in January, is he going to reverse course on what the Obama administration has done? And if so, if he wants to get tough with Cuba, what does that mean? Does that mean that he breaks relations all over again? Does that mean that he presses Cuba in some way for more concessions when it comes to dissidents and basic freedoms? And if so, how is that going to be received in Havana? I would argue that, yes, of course, we're talking about one of the most iconic leaders, for good or ill, that this hemisphere has ever produced. But his passing came at a time when he had already essentially handed the reins of power over. Maybe there will come some change, but I suspect that will come after the year 2018, which is when Raul Castro has pledged to step aside, if in fact he follows through on that commitment.
Well, Fidel Castro had been asked before he passed what would happen when he died, and he said, well, probably nothing, because there are many old revolutionaries ready to take control after me. And he was right. And the fact that he had time to actually transfer power to his brother in a rather orderly way, and there was this pretty large overlap between the two.
I would argue that there have been those who have been predicting the demise of Fidelismo, which was Fidel's particular brand of socialism, for decades and decades. And Fidel Castro outlived almost every one of those people who made those predictions.
Thank you so much for your insights. Our VOA Senate correspondent, Michael Bowman, who was at one time our Miami Bureau correspondent and much connected with the stories that were going on in that region. Thank you so much, Michael.
Always a pleasure.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has threatened to break off the migrant deal his country struck in March with the European Union and allow refugees to cross into Europe. It follows a largely symbolic vote by the European Parliament Thursday to freeze membership negotiations with Ankara. The EU, along with the United States, has voiced concern over the extent of the crackdown on the opposition following the failed military coup in July. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan reacted with trademark anger Friday to the vote by the EU Parliament.
Bana bak, eğer daha ileri giderseniz bu sınır kapıları da açılır, bunu da bilin.
He warned that if it goes any further, Turkey's border gates will be opened, calling the EU vote an empty threat. Analysts say Ankara believes it holds a trump card in threatening to break off the deal. Under the March agreement, Turkey agreed to take back all migrants crossing illegally to Europe in return for over $3 billion in aid and the speeding up of EU membership talks. But that threat is losing its potency, says Turkey analyst Kamran Matin of the University of Sussex.
Because by now, most European countries have actually set in place certain frameworks and practices in relation to the migration. So that won't be an immediate problem.
The EU Parliament vote was not binding, and the bloc's executive branch, the Commission, is unlikely to act on it.
They are unhappy with what's going on in Turkey, but they don't want to be the side, the party which initiates the suspension of the talks, because that's, they think, is what Erdogan is looking for in order to tell Turkish people that it wasn't us, they actually ended the accession talks.
But the European Union has been increasingly vocal in condemning Turkey's crackdown following July's failed coup. Over 110,000 people have been sacked or suspended from their jobs, and over 36,000 people jailed pending trial. In turn, Ankara has accused Europe of siding with terrorists. With such apparently irreconcilable differences, some observers say Turkey could push for a so-called two-tier Europe alongside other states outside the bloc, like analyst Hasan Turunç of Oxford University. Countries like Norway, Switzerland, maybe Britain and maybe Turkey, an EU with two gears, says Turunç, adding that such a model may be more acceptable for Germany and France. Meanwhile, NATO says several Turkish military personnel have sought asylum in Europe following the post-coup crackdown. Member states will hear each case individually, but the granting of asylum would likely strain relations with Ankara even further. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Here in the United States, there's good news and bad news for shoppers, thanks to the National Retail Federation, which says the good news is expect some big discounts on electronic items and clothing as the holiday shopping season officially gets underway. The bad news is the bad guys are going online to get a piece of that action. Millar Sega has more.
It's become something of a tradition after the Thanksgiving holiday. Long lines of eager shoppers looking for Black Friday discounts. And this year, retailers are predicting another bumper year.
When we look at the entire holiday season, we're forecasting $656 billion is what the retail industry is going to make just during the holidays.
That's up nearly 4% over last year and sharply higher than the 10-year average of 2.5%. To avoid big crowds, savvy shoppers are increasingly shopping online. As much as 10% of gifts this year will be purchased online by smartphone or home computer. Due to the added safeguards on credit cards, many criminals will be shopping that way too.
Because of the chip cards now, it's a lot more difficult for retail criminals to do in-store fraud, so they're taking it online.
Security experts say as much as 1.2% of all smartphone transactions are likely to be fraudulent. The average illegal transaction, around $200. That doesn't include another electronic scam that's making the rounds, fake returns.
They'll create, with some cut and paste, a fraudulent invoice and bring it back and say, I received this as a gift online, and here's my invoice.
Banking experts expect a 43% surge in fraudulent purchases this year. They're urging customers to change their passwords often, avoid clicking suspicious ads or emails, and make sure consumers shop only from secure and legitimate websites. Millar Sega, VOA News, Washington.
Millar Sega, one of the good guys, and you can find his story on our website at voanews.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE and like us on Facebook at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. More than 150 million people around the world need glasses but don't have them. Many have become used to seeing an out-of-focus world and don't even realize that they have a vision impairment. But poor vision can have a negative impact on their education, employment, and quality of life. Now designers from India have developed a low-cost, easy-to-assemble eye test device that could help millions of people in the developing world see more clearly. Faith Lapidus has details.
Getting your vision tested could involve a sophisticated phoropter with dozens of lenses of different strengths. Or it could mean a few minutes with the folding phoropter and its two lenses from the L.V. Prasad Eye Institute in Hyderabad, India.
It's really intuitive to actually use this device, and then using that they'll be able to know if they actually need to go to a visual expert.
Assembling the device is a lot like doing origami. The two sheets of cardboard are folded into oblong boxes, and a small lens is attached at each end. Then the boxes slide together. The patient looks through the device at an eye chart and slides the boxes apart until the image is in focus. The pointer shows the refractive error, or how strong the glasses need to be.
The scenario right now is that there are a lot of people who actually do not have access to refractive error screening. And because they can't do that, many people go visually impaired.
The developers hope to get the folding phoropter, which costs less than half a dollar, into the hands of millions of people who don't have access to eye care, giving them the power of self-diagnosis. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
No glasses needed to listen to International Edition, but if you do want to look at our program, you can find us at voanews.com. Also like us on Facebook at VOA Now and follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Thomas Blondet. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thanks so much for joining us today. Have a great day ahead. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Addressing climate change has been one of the key objectives of the administration of President Barack Obama. It took nearly 8 years and a lot of hard work, but at last, 2016, President Obama's final year in office, has seen enormous strides in this effort. The Obama administration seeks to achieve three major goals. First, the entry into force of the Paris Climate Agreement, which aims to keep the temperature rise well below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Second, addressing the growth of international aviation emissions. And finally, the gradual reduction of the production and consumption of hydrofluorocarbons, or HFCs. These chemicals, which are commonly used in refrigeration, can have 10,000 times more global warming potential than carbon dioxide. All three of these goals were reached within a few weeks of each other. The Paris Agreement, which was adopted by nearly 200 countries last December, passed the last of two entry into force thresholds in late September and had, in fact, entered into force on November 4th. In early October, the United Nations International Civil Aviation Organization agreed to a global measure that will offset emissions from international civil aviation, ensuring that emissions from this growing sector don't rise above 2020 levels. And on October 15th, nearly 200 parties of the Montreal Protocol agreed to an amendment that will reduce global HFC levels by 80 to 85% by the year 2047. As a result of this legally binding accord, temperatures could be decreased by as much as half a degree Celsius by the end of the century. Our community of nations finally understands the magnitude of what we are up against. I believe we've all learned that none of our nations, not one of us, is equipped to deal with this generational task all by ourselves, said Secretary of State John Kerry. And I believe we all recognize that it is time to meet this global threat with all of the seriousness and all of the purpose and all of the commitment that it demands, and to do what we must do to urgently meet this need now, and to do so boldly.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.